I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with Indiana's new Superintendent of Public Instruction, Glenda Ritz. After Ritz, a Democrat, claimed victory in the November elections, former Governor Mitch Daniels, current Governor Mike Pence, and legislative leaders, all Republicans, said her victory didn't mean anything. Since then, a kind of tug-of-war over education policy has taken place. We will talk with Ritz about where she plans to take the state schools and students, and about how she plans to do it. We'll talk about vouchers, about grades for schools and teachers, about Common Core, and about what's best for Indiana's children. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits at WFYI.org, or connecting with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with the new state superintendent of public instruction, Glenda Ritz. Glenda, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
It's good to have you here. If you would like to join this conversation, please call us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I'm going to start actually this show with a bit of a mea culpa of sorts. When you were running for state superintendent of public instruction, in my other lives, I write a column for the State House File and some of our sister publications. There were a lot of people out there who were saying, oh, you need to pay attention to the superintendent of public instruction race. It's close. And almost all of us in the press corps were just sort of shaking our heads saying, oh, no, this is a blowout. And you actually, it turned out to be a bit of a blowout, but not in the way that everyone anticipated. So I wanted to start this program first by acknowledging I was wrong, but second by saying, you know, Why did you think that you won that race? Because my reaction was not one in isolation.
Yeah, you're right. All the journalists were not giving me a break there. Actually, they were giving me lots of breaks. I was getting lots of airtime. Yeah. But about a month out, I was the one, probably the only one, that was traveling around the state that really saw the energy. We had, in my campaign, very methodical about the campaign and hired a group of people that really knew how to run a campaign. We ran it with about six people, mm-hmm. and that was our core. But we knew that our base was way beyond where we anticipated it to be. So I was very confident when you get emails from educators who say they just sent out postcards on their own to 300 people on their Christmas card list, or they stayed up till 2 a.m. to make sure that they were going to, you know, do certain tasks in the next week. Educators were talking all over, but it wasn't just educators. There were parent coalitions all mm-hmm. over the state of Indiana. And so it was a fun thing. And about a month out, I really felt very confident that we were going to pull that off.
Well, and what accounted for the energy there? Why were people as concerned? Because let's face it, normally this is not a real high-profile race either. Why is it that they were so passionate? What issues provoked that
Well,
energy?
Education is a very important topic. Mm-hmm. And when we started the race, you know, I said to the people that were going to help me run it, I said, this is going to be a race about education policy. Mm-hmm. And of course, they scoffed and said, oh, Glenda, you know, political races are not about policy. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, this one's going to be. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that it was. You know, education policy was very important. There were some key areas that resonated when throughout the entire state. One was testing. People that knew educators and knew what was happening in classrooms or had connections somehow knew that we were doing a lot of testing and wanting to get back to really some good instruction and less testing. So that was a big, huge piece that resonated statewide. Then the other actually is a topic that legislative action we'll need to take, mm-hmm. but people aren't necessarily familiar with how that all happens. And that would be the use of public funds for public schools. Mm-hmm. So charters and vouchers were important topics throughout the race. So anyhow, I think people wanted to see change in a different direction, a positive direction with education, and that's what we're going to do.
Well, and I'm glad you raised that, because that I mentioned in the intro to the show that right after you got elected, former Governor Mitch Daniels and current Governor Mike Pence and legislative leaders basically said your election doesn't change anything. It's not going to change the course of education policy here in the state. I think Governor Daniels even said, I appoint a board that you have to report to. How are you going to go about changing education policy, if that's what you want to do? What powers will you have to do that? And then what areas are you going to try to change?
Well, actually, things are going very well concerning policy direction. I'm feeling very confident about that. I have never gotten to choose the parents I work with or mm-hmm. the colleagues or administrators or school board or superintendents, and I've never asked anybody's political party. I am truly an educator that ran mm-hmm. for this position, and I've been talking with everybody. I have both parties coming to me asking for language, talking about changes. There's a lot of support for coming up with a new accountability system rather than the A to F that was mm-hmm. enacted just during the race, actually. There's a lot of common areas in education that I feel a majority of the legislators are in support of, that I'm actually in support of. I think many people had a misconception of some of my positions when I ran. Take charter schools, for instance. Mm-hmm. There are many people who think that I'm totally against charter schools, which is untrue. Mm-hmm. I'm actually for local charters that have a local need. Local communities have local needs. They have a local process by which they approve those and then evaluate them. What I'm opposed to is the statewide charter board being established to mm-hmm. simply bring in charters to set up schools within our state where there's not a local need mm-hmm. and from the community. So, you know, we've got common ground in a lot of places with the legislature and the State Board of Education. Oh, my gosh. You know, I've been meeting one to one with each one of the members, and they all have their special talents. And I think we're going to be working just fine together.
We are talking with new State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Glenda Ritz. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Rich in St. John, Indiana. Says, Ms. Ritz, I recently thought of becoming an elementary school teacher. Every teacher said don't do it because the curriculum is badly mandated and so paperwork heavy, teachers are not allowed the freedom, creativity, or ability to teach anymore. I would like to know how you plan to bridge the relationship between teachers and their jobs so they may be creative again.
And that's one of the reasons that I ran for this position. Testing was so heavy and the high stakes of the testing so demanding that school districts all over the state of Indiana were putting in more assessments to see that students were on level to pass the pass-fail test that was going to happen at the end of the school year. Actually, one of the first things that I want to try to do is to move from a pass-fail approach to a growth model assessment, true growth model assessment.
What is a growth model
That means assessment? That we would assess students in reading, for instance, at the beginning of the year and the end of the year, and see their actual growth within the year mm-hmm. Rather than a pass-fail test at the end of the year. That way we can monitor that. We know where they're all starting. We know where they're going to all be. In the secondary level in particular, we've not really known the reading levels of students entering our classrooms. So, you know, Indiana's never had data on the reading mm-hmm. levels of our students. It's about time we did, because literacy is one of the most important things that we can do to be sure that kids are going to be successful. So actually switching the model in which we do assessments, it's going to ease that pressure. It's going to allow teachers to get in that creative mode and get kids excited about reading, get kids excited about in-depth instruction, and really have more reading going on. It's not about teaching kids to read. It's about developing cultures of readers.
We've gotten another listener question. Looks like this one is a tweet. Says, How can you ensure parent or student voices have a role in discussions about policy?
Oh, well, you know, I plan to actually have, when I need to form committees and commissions and or I'm out and about, we're going to be putting parents on committees. We're not just going to have educators. We're going to actually include conversation. The example of the Common Core that I gave testimony on yesterday mm-hmm. is a good example of that. The process for changing standards actually is to form a committee and then to bring it to the round table and then bring it to the state board for approval. I want to expand that to include public comment. And, you know, even the nine different districts that we have, congressional districts, I want to hear the parent voice. They have a stake in this, and we want to talk openly about where we might be headed regarding standards and move forward in a positive way together.
Well, and I hear obviously the argument you're making that you've never gotten to choose parents or anything like that that you work with, so this is not a new situation, a new dynamic for you, but obviously there has been some resistance to the idea of you know, changing course or changing policy in regard to education. Who in state government are your allies right now? Who are the folks that the legislators perhaps that you are working with or that you think you're going to be able to work with?
Oh gosh. You know, they're numerous, Republicans and Democrats, really. I have many Republicans who are coming to me to ask me for, you know, suggestions with language. Very involved. I've been meeting one-to-one with everyone on the education committees, mm-hmm. and I feel very comfortable about that. I think I've completed meeting with everybody one-to-one on the Senate Education Committee, and I'm working my way through finishing up the House of Representatives. And so I plan to really do a lot of communication. Mm-hmm. I'm actually going to put out a newsletter, which will probably be the first ever, mm-hmm. from the Department of Education to legislators. I want to keep them informed, and I've been telling them that. I said, you know, as laws are enacted or I'm starting to work with different groups on different policy mm-hmm. issues, I want you to be informed about that. I think that's what's been missing, really, the last 4 years is the dialogue, mm-hmm. The communication and the dialogue and really making sure that everybody, you know, is having a good feeling about where we're headed.
Well, and in fairness, some of the legislators have indicated that they felt like they'd been dictated to by the executive branch and wanted to have a more active role. Could you talk about specifically, you know, some lawmakers who have been particularly receptive? Who the names are?
Oh, gosh, I've been speaking with several. I've been in contact, obviously, with Senator Cruz, mm-hmm. Who heads the Education Committee. So he and I have met several times regarding matters. I've met with everyone on the Senate Education Committee already, I think. And, you know, I've had conversations with Senator Kinley mm-hmm. on numerous occasions. And so, you know, I'm actually Senator Charbonneau is actually carrying a bill that I'm in support of, so that we can redo A to F. But, you know, I've had numerous legislators, you know, mm-hmm. dialogue regarding language. That's not really, you know, and I think everybody was afraid of that I would want to come in and, you know, tweak language, you know, and actually change language, you mm-hmm. know, that they put in place. And that's not really what I want at all. I was really about the implementation of the law. Mm-hmm. I don't have as many questions or concerns about the law as I do the rule and the policy making that was going on after the law was enacted. Mm-hmm. So I have a different approach to enacting the parameters of the law.
So the law, meaning the A to F?
Actually, A to F is not in law.
Yeah.
A to F is actually in policy, but legislators have felt that they need to have their voice spoken regarding mm-hmm. that and want to send a direction on where we should head with that. Concerning teacher evaluation, for instance, mm-hmm. I had a big role in that, actually, working with Senator Cruz and Boehning and Dr. Bennett 2 years ago, and very versed in that piece of law. And the impetus with that, you know, I'm not really suggesting any changes to that law. However, the implementation of the evaluation system, as Dr. Bennett wanted to do with RISE, many teachers mm-hmm. are very concerned with the RISE evaluation that many school districts signed on to, but that's not what they need to do. RISE is a is a suggestion. Mm-hmm. And so it's not in law nor policy. So that requires conversation with the superintendents to develop their own local system for evaluation within the parameters of the law. So I intend to actually have conversation with the superintendent shortly to go over the parameters of the law and tell them to go forth and develop their local systems.
What, you know, in terms of the first thing, you're not even, your inauguration's still coming up. So please.
Actually, I am already sworn in.
Okay.
I was sworn in front of my students. It was great at Crooked Creek. It was an absolutely wonderful experience on November 29 after the elections were certified. I gave a presentation to the entire student body, K through 5, and a PowerPoint presentation. And the last slide was of the State House. And I said, this is where my new office is going to be. And the kids all went, whoa. and then the superintendent of my school district said, well, let's send Mrs. Ritz off with a little love. And they all did little hearts with that. And then I told him, I said, well, the last thing that I have to do is get sworn in. So I brought my childhood Bible today, and I got sworn in on that day. But I have a public swearing in Saturday.
We are talking with Glenda Ritz, the new state superintendent of public instruction. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with Glenda Ritz, the new state superintendent of public instruction. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Kristen, looks like, says, you talked about parent voice. What about getting student voices more involved in the discussion regarding education?
Oh, well, you know, that's a great question so that I can talk about the reorganization of the Department of Education. We're going to be establishing outreach coordinators in 9 regions in congressional regions in the state of Indiana to actually support the school districts. And when we do that, we're going to be interested in addressing school culture, not just, you know, your scores on math and science, but we're really going to talk about, you know, what makes a great school. And so we're going to be working with our school improvement process to do that. And you know what? We need to gather information from students. So gathering information from students as part of that school culture process, I think, is going to be very valuable in making sure that we can provide the proper support for our schools. Those outreach coordinators will be responsible for working with the schools on their school improvement processes and also gathering community support in whatever fashion that might be needed to make improvements.
Well, and I'm going to take a step back now and ask, since we've sort of framed the fact that you've come in and there was in the overarching umbrella they talk about it as education reform, but there've been some significant policy changes in Indiana in the past few years in terms of some of the laundry list. Obviously, you've indicated you want to change the A through F system, probably make some changes in regard to testing so that, we're assessing students in a different way. The growth model, I think, is what you used. How about vouchers? Where are you on the idea of school vouchers? Indiana now has one of the, most sweeping voucher programs in the country.
Well, my position won't sway. I am for public dollars going to public schools, and that position will not change. But obviously, I have to follow the law, and whatever is enacted, I need to be sure that I'm doing that. The Indiana Supreme Court has yet to decide if it's constitutional in the state of Indiana to have the voucher system that's in place. But I plan to execute the law as I'm supposed to, but I will never be a proponent of that. I truly do believe that public dollars should go to public schools.
Well, and then the other piece of that is sort of the reward system. We saw in Governor Pence's budget proposal that came out earlier this week, his education funding plans involve, I think, a 1% increase. The schools will get, if I remember the figures correctly, $63 million in the first year of the two-year budget cycle to split among themselves. But in the second year, there's an additional $64 million where only the schools that get either an A or B grade on the current grading system would get those funds, or have a 90% graduation rate, or I think 90% of the third graders passing a standardized reading test. Is that an approach to incentivizing education and performance, one that you support?
Actually, I'd actually have to say that I'm not in support of that type of reward system. I would prefer more flexibility for schools that are doing high performance. I believe that all schools need to have the proper funding in order to run their programs. I'd like to see a different way in approaching that. Schools that are struggling with performance are struggling because of other school culture issues that are in place. And dollars are needed in order to address those issues. So I'm about, you're going to see me be about equity. I want to see opportunities for all kids in the state of Indiana. I don't believe that we should give money to some and not to others in order to provide equal programming in terms of whatever it might be, in terms of paying teachers, in making sure that we're getting the best quality teachers in all of our schools, whether it be technology, making sure all of our students have access to technology, whether it be opportunities in coursework, making sure that all kids have access to equal opportunities to advance in coursework and career tech education. So we'll be having some dialogue regarding those issues that have been put forth. We do need more money in education. A few years back, we lost $350 million in the middle of an academic year. I'd like to see that replaced, actually, with part of the surplus that we have. So, yeah, we're going to be having some dialogue regarding those types of
and
reward systems.
And you say you're going to be having some dialogue.
Correct.
I presume that, did the governor consult with you?
I have not had a conversation regarding that issue.
In regard to the funding for
Correct.
The state schools
Correct.
Or anything,
Correct.
Anything like that? Well, in terms of, I'm sure that the argument on the other side here is going to be one of, okay, we're building these incentives in to reward performance and to establish standards of accountability and try to do it, in a positive way. What system of accountability would you like to see in place for the state schools?
Well, actually, I think it can be vastly simplified once we get some growth model measures in there, because then we simply could be as easy as reporting the percentage of students that actually showed a year's worth of growth at your school. This school had 92%, this school had 47%, this school had 82%, and actually work from those numbers to improve. I think improvement is all about support, to be honest. It's not about you rising to the occasion because there's dollars at the end. I think it's all about support, and in a great many instances, it's about community support. So those outreach coordinators that I'm going to put in place are vital to making sure that all students and all schools are going to have what they need to be good. If we want to, I guess that could be a goal of mine, that all schools are going to have A's and B's. And we'll make that happen however we need to make that go. But those outreach coordinators are going to be very important. It's a whole different philosophy on how we go about improving our schools.
We are talking with State Superintendent of Public Instruction Glenda Ritz here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Your question, please.
Yes, I've been told by educators that Indiana Public Schools will not diagnose a child with dyslexia, that they use instead the labels specific disability in the area of reading. And because of this, they are somehow not required to remediate as they would be with a diagnosis of dyslexia under federal law. My question is this true? And if so, what does Mrs. Ritz intend to do about it? Just a footnote here, my daughter was in one of her classes when she taught at Fox Hill School, and to this day at age 30, she says Mrs. Ritz was the best teacher she ever had.
Oh, well,
thank you
very much for the call, Ellen. We'll try to get an answer for your question.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Actually, that's kind of an opportune question, because I just met with the Foundation for Dyslexia, and so we had a great conversation. Actually, was talking with them to train more teachers in how to work with children who have dyslexia in their initial training, in their pre-service training, so that more teachers would have some of those skills, like using the Orton-Gillingham method and having those where they need to have them. Actually, dyslexia itself is in some cases more of a medical, sometimes a medical diagnosis. And so the school doesn't have the capacity to do that, but you might need an outside person to actually identify that. But the services that are given to the students, because if that student is identified with special needs, they are entitled to the services to meet, to be actually address their reading deficiency. And so methodologies that are used with students who have dyslexia should be in place. And so that was one of the reasons I was having the conversation with the Dyslexia Association and Marion University to try to get some programs going and support that, actually. So I'm very interested in literacy. I'm a special education teacher. Mm-hmm. I'm also a general education teacher and a library science teacher. So reading is going to be a big focus, and I think you'll see some great programming, making sure that we have in place for students with special needs.
Well, that raises a question. I mean, you was running for public office something that you really had on your bucket list, or the thing that you wanted to do? Because when you speak about education, you can tell that there's a passion for it, that you're a teacher and consider yourself a teacher. Why did you make this run?
Actually, it was never on my list. I never have aspired to do a role like this. I've had many leadership positions, actually have shied away from taking administrative positions for the sole reason that I really loved the kids. I loved the classroom atmosphere. But I had many leadership roles at an administrative level in Washington Township. But I got into this race really when iRead 3 went in place, when the state of Indiana started keeping a retention list of third graders. That was my line in the sand. I had been very involved in policy. I'm a National Board Certified Teacher. I'm on the board of directors of that association at the national level. I'm highly involved in national policy making and teacher evaluation, teacher quality. And so I'd been involved with the legislature 2 years ago with teacher evaluation. I knew how laws are enacted. I know about how policy is promulgated. And I thought, if no one else is going to step up, then that has the capability to actually do those types of things, I guess it's going to be me.
We are talking with State Superintendent of Public Instruction Glenda Ritz here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Jim, welcome to the program.
Congratulations, Superintendent.
Thank you.
Have one question. You had mentioned that struggling schools and making sure that they get the equity that they need, which is obviously the money to run their schools. But if you don't tie anything to performance, how do you expect your administration to be different than past administrations dealing with those schools? And I guess the second question, in order to just more of a comment, I want to remind you that all of the public money that you're referring to comes from the private citizens of the state of Indiana, and the majority of them support this tuition credit that they get for being able to choose where they send their schools. And I'll take my question and your answer off the air. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Jim. Well, in terms of actually, I think one of the questions in there was linked to merit pay for teachers. Do you support that?
Actually, I do. I have high accountability. I think we need a fair system to do that, and that's why I want to move to the growth models. Because when you have growth measures in place, you're responsible for the students in your class for that year, then you can actually see the improvement. And I believe in high accountability for teachers. Also, I believe in linking that to student assessment. So I plan to have a very rigorous program of accountability. A lot of people think that I'm wanting to do away with accountability. Just the opposite. it. I want to have very rigorous accountability pieces tied to actually the school cultures that are in place. In addition, teachers need to be held accountable as well. And I think they're actually willing to be held accountable. We just need a fair system to be sure that we're doing that. So I feel that people will, they'll know that that's where I am.
Well, and in terms of Jim's question, too, I guess in listening to him, he made the argument as well that the vast majority of the public supports, it sounded like vouchers. He referred to it as a tax credit system. But to some degree, that's the argument we started talking about here. I mean, has there been this... and. That's kind of the argument that we heard Governor Daniels and Governor Pence advancing in terms of, do you ever feel like saying to these folks, you know, I did get more votes. I did win.
Well, I did. I did. But I'm one person. I think when it comes to the voucher system or charter schools, you know, the public will be speaking about that. They speak every election time. So if they feel that Indiana needs to head a different direction regarding policy on certain issues, then they'll vote that way. I think my vote and my win of getting over 1.3 million, it was a nonpartisan race. They wanted to see a different direction in education. I plan to deliver that and work with people to make things happen in a positive way in our schools. Regarding legislative issues that I'm one person, you know, the public will have to have its voice. I'm not sure that they've had their full voice on those topics yet.
How will you, you know, we've talked about accountability. How will you hold yourself accountable? I mean, what standards are you setting for your own performance as, you know, at the end of the day, you know, will you say, or at the end of however long your term of service is, you'll say, I was successful or I was not successful in terms of getting done what I wanted. What are your goals for the office? What constitutes success for
you? Well, I actually kind of spelled those out in the campaign. I want more time on instruction in the classroom and less time on testing. And I hope to be able to move towards that. I talked about having a fair accountability system, both for our schools and for our educators, and that's on my radar. I talked about making sure that our schools are safe and secure and want to make sure that we've got proper disciplinary programs in place that are going to give a positive view to being at our schools. You know, and I did talk about making sure that we're going to have funding and equitability in terms of technology and opportunities and career tech. So I have them listed. Actually, they're on every agenda item, a meeting that I have. So they're always in front of me to make sure that we're always going to be headed in that direction. So I'll be using that as my yardstick to see, did I do what the voters elected me to do?
We are talking about schools, Indiana schools, here with the new state superintendent of public instruction, Glenda Ritz. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Diane, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for letting me come in.
Certainly.
My question is about special needs students. As you mentioned, you were a teacher. For special needs. And my son, I feel like the current system failed him. And with regard to the ISTEP, children have to be accommodated all through school at their level of learning. And then when it gets to the ISTEP, it's all the same for regular ed students. And I wanted to see if that at all was on your agenda for trying to work out the kinks with regard to that. Because my son got to the point where in the 11th grade, he said, Mom, I'm not going to pass the ISTEP. Why should I continue?
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the question, Diane. Okay, well, in terms of ISTEP, differentiating the
Yeah,
the
well, actually, I think when we move from a pass-fail to a growth model, you know, those types of concerns really kind of are diminished because kids will be looking at their growth for every individual child, and we can see their progress. It won't be just a pass-fail approach to moving on or to getting, you know, what you to graduating, or it'll be a growth model assessment. So we can always see where kids are moving. And I think that's going to relieve the stress that she's talking about on the students and on the parents and on the teachers. There's a lot of high stakes testing that's been going on, and it's very stressful for all the parties.
We are talking today on No Limits with Glenda Ritz, the new state superintendent of public instruction. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. We're talking with Glenda Ritz. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with Glenda Ritz, who is the new state superintendent of public instruction. They need to shorten that title.
I know.
Sometimes I would think you'd get your tongue twisted trying to say that over and over again. You can join the conversation by connecting with us through Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. In fact, we've gotten a tweet from a listener named Stefan, I think, says, refreshing to see a voice of reason in education administration, and says, would like your opinion of No Child Left Behind and standardized testing.
Oh, well, No Child Left Behind, I hope, finally, is going to get a revision at the U.S. level. There are lots of issues with it, and everybody knows it, regarding testing, actually. And so it's coming to an end, actually. It's all of we're supposed to have 100% of all kids in the entire nation passing their test by 2014-15, and that's, you know, that's not going to be the case. And we all knew that when it was first passed. And so we're hoping that it gets rewritten and get some what they call common sense into that law so that we can operate with more common sense here in the states. And I think every superintendent in the nation is hoping that. Regarding testing, I think I'm pretty clear on that. I want to see it simplified. I want to see testing that actually has meaningful data that's given to educators and parents and students as to their true levels of performance. So that we know how to best get the resources and instruction to the children. And then I want to see less of it. You know, I want kids to enjoy learning. Teachers know how to check for understanding within their coursework. That's what we hire them to do, to be the experts in making sure that they know how their kids are doing.
We are talking with Glenda Ritz here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Just fine, you?
Just fine, and Glenda Ritz, I'm so glad that you have been elected, and I know I did my best on Facebook to help get you elected. So.
Thank you. I had a great social media going on.
You did. I had a lot of people say, you know, that's the only Democrat that I voted for, and, that's saying a lot. I have so many things to say. First of all, I'm a teacher. I started late in life, so I've been teaching 10 years, but I didn't start until I was 33. And, you know, the difficulties just on maintaining a teacher's license, I think that people who aren't teachers, they don't really understand. So it's interesting. I actually have a Rules 2002 and a 4647 license that I have to maintain individually. They expire at different times. They have different requirements. So that in itself, taking classes, PGP points, people understand how much work that we put in on our time off, quote-unquote, our summer vacation, which has gotten so short, I think now we only get 9 weeks and we're not even on a balanced schedule. So, I mean, there's just, I wish people would just understand that teachers, in my opinion, are the hardest working people I've ever met, and they don't want to harm children. They spend so much of their time and effort helping kids, and then they just take this kind of witch hunt, and they just, so many good teachers just drop out of the profession.
Well, thank you very much for the call, Greg. We'll deal with your question now.
Actually, there's no disagreement with me. We are struggling to get new teachers to come into the profession. Mm-hmm. Most of the colleges have seen a drop in the number of students that have been applying to the field of education. We do need to have more dialogue regarding licensure, mm-hmm. And how to do that renewal process and simplify that. But yeah, teachers are very hardworking, and you know, there's not a lot of pay in that job, and you can advance up and it's even harder now with the new compensation model that we have to put in place. But teachers do work hard on behalf of children, and we need to be sure that they are working in a very positive atmosphere. And mm-hmm. that's what I hope to do. I appreciate the phone call. But, yes, we do have quite a bit of work to do to be sure that our profession remains strong and viable with some good pre-service training.
Well, I guess I would be remiss if I didn't ask this question, because part of, you know, the argument for standardized testing is also that parents want some assurance that, you know, that their children have achieved basic minimum competencies. Yes, getting the progress reports and the, you know, being able to analyze how they're doing is helpful, but they also want to know, okay, are we hitting at least this mark along the way? What would you say to those parents who want that reassurance?
Oh, there's going to be marks along the way. You know, just putting in a growth model assessment where you can see the growth during the year, there's going to be more substantial information given out so that you actually know that your child is performing at and above their grade level. Probably get more detail now than you would under the current system, because we need to not only know the level of growth, but we want to be sure that they're always performing at a level that's acceptable. So there'll be two different types of benchmarks in place.
Debbie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. Your question, please.
I'm a therapist in the public schools, and I have a real quandary in reference to our kids who are in life skills classrooms, and they are not on a high school diploma track. And yet we are focusing on things like, you know, verbs and adjectives and things that are not what I would consider functional skills to be independent when they leave the high school, so that they can, you know, make their own bed, so they can toilet themselves, so they can make a meal. I mean, we have it, but it's not the primary focus. And I'm wondering, do we plan to address that in the future? Because I just feel like the teachers are so focused on those testing.
Thank you very much for the question, Debbie. Well,
and that has been one of the issues, especially with No Child Left Behind, with the federal mandates, you know, we're really only allowed to count up to 1% and then 2% of special needs students actually within to be exempt from the testing. And so therein lies the first issue that I hope gets addressed under No Child Left Behind. Regarding curriculum, there is alternate curriculum for students with special needs, and that should be developed at the local level and should be utilized. I am totally a proponent of making sure all of our kids are prepared for the workforce when they leave. And thus, Governor Pence and I are going to be working on a very large initiative regarding career and tech education. I want all kids, no matter what their level, to be exposed to different types of opportunities with careers. Kids nowadays, with college being so expensive, they need to be leaving high school to go into to perhaps even go into a job situation to earn good money to pay for their college. And then, you know, we have students who do not finish higher education or go directly into the workforce, and they need to have something too. So everyone needs to be exposed to some career and tech opportunities, and I hope you'll see a big focus on that, and that definitely will help out the special needs students.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Kenny, and you can email questions to NoLimits at nolimits@wfyi.org. Kenny's question is, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right because it's an unusual spelling of Kenny. When I was in Indiana public schools in the 50s and 60s, there was a clear commitment throughout the state that all public school students would have the best education possible. It was effectively accomplished without burdensome testing and other administrative conceits. This state produced Nobel laureates and leaders in all fields who are now throughout the world from that public education era. I congratulate you for wanting to bring back an egalitarian model of public education that serves all children and an approach to privatization that holds it accountable to taxpayers. All of us should be relieved that for the first time in many years, we have someone of your ethical outlook running Indiana secondary education. Please comment. Thank you.
Wow, I appreciate that comment. That's true. It's a tall order to actually live up to, and so lots of support's going to be needed from constituencies throughout Indiana. But you know, it's true. We've gotten away from what I call common sense. You know, fads in education come and go. They really do. But best practices stay. Mm-hmm. And good educators use those best practices on a very regular basis. We are in an age of technology, and I think that has actually prompted a lot of the data collection and more testing. We have an awful lot of vendors out there in the nation where this is their business, and education is a big business. But the author of that email is correct. You know, simplifying things sometimes the best thing to actually do, and we only need enough data to know what we need to be doing. So I'm hoping to actually move that way.
Well, and speaking of being in a new age of technology, we've gotten a tweet, something unheard of just a few years ago, from a listener named Andy, who says wants to know if you believe poverty impacts student and school performances and what your thoughts are about schools as partners in anti-poverty work.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'm first of all going to say that I think the biggest impact in student learning is not poverty. It is actually reading. And I think when we make sure that kids, especially those in poverty, have access to reading, and we can get them at an early age. And I'm hoping that kindergarten is for the first time going to be fully funded, full day, and perhaps even be mandated. When we get young children in and we can get the reading going and get those young minds working, reading actually crosses all economic levels. And when students are strong readers, they will succeed. I actually come from a family of very modest income, and we didn't have a lot of advantages. I'm the only member of my family who's graduated from college and gone on to an actual profession to speak. My other brothers and sisters are successful, but I went actually the route of becoming an educator. And poverty itself, I want kids to read.
Mm-hmm.
And when kids know that they've got that kind of power to be able to succeed in their classrooms, despite the poverty level they might come from, they will rise to the occasion.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Amy. I'm going to synthesize it. It's about the flu. And first ask you to emphasize that all school workers and students should receive flu shots. But she closes with a question, says, also, when schools are closed due to extreme illness outbreaks, how is the instructional time made up?
Well, right now, I think it's made up at the end of the school year.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have 5 hours to constitute a day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's really schools right now are allowed to start late, you know, for a 2-hour period at the most, and still count as a full day, because most school days are seven and a half hours for the students.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now it's at the end of the school year, you know, that they're made up. I have to really investigate that. I've not really had a chance to actually, determine what's in law and what's in policy regarding makeup of school time. So I'm getting my feet wet, just started Monday, but that is a topic I have to investigate.
Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. Your question, please.
Yeah, I have a second grader, and I'm concerned about how there's no longer cursive handwriting being taught in Indiana schools, and was wondering what the superintendent had to say about that.
Well, thank you very much for the question, Mary. Cursive handwriting.
Yeah,
it's a bill in front of the legislature.
Yeah, cursive handwriting. Well, first of all, let me clarify that we every school district can have cursive handwriting. That's the first thing that you need to know. And no matter what the standards are, you can have cursive handwriting. The conversation came up when Indiana adopted the Common Core in 2010, and the Common Core standards did not include cursive. And so
probably
there,
ought to explain what Common Core is.
Common Core is a set of standards that has been adopted for about 45 states. And so when those standards were approved by the State Board of Education, then it did not include cursive writing. And basically what happened is there was a, really, it was a memo sent out from the Department of Education, Dr. Mm-hmm. Bennett, that said, you know, since they're not in the standards, you know, do if you want to teach it, you can. If you don't want to teach it, that's okay too. And therein lies the debate. And so really, my personal view on it is that cursive writing is needed, not for the act of writing, because you can choose to write in cursive or printing mm-hmm. as you wish, but it's for the act of reading.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't have any instruction in how to write it, then you won't be able to read it. And so, you know, students who have not learned the differencing in the letters and associated those with the printed letter, they can't read cursive. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't stopped writing cursive mm-hmm. in the state of Indiana. People are still writing letters. People are still doing mm-hmm. things in cursive and will for a long time and throughout the entire world. So my personal opinion, the teaching of cursive is about reading mm-hmm. cursive writing.
Well, and it sounds like in listening to you, everything comes back to reading. For you.
It does.
That's the key to the kingdom as far what should we be doing that we're not doing now then to enhance literacy reading?
Oh gosh, I got a lot of answers to that, and we're going to have a big kickoff this summer. We're going to have a family literacy program that's going to be very extensive. I've already gotten a group of people together to start dialogue from public libraries to reading nonprofit groups that assist with reading, whether it be with adult literacy or children's literacy, public schools, obviously, all schools we're going to be involving. We're going to have a huge literacy focus and talk about then best practices as we head into the school year. I actually firmly believe that we have been relegating ourselves to teaching kids how to read. We need to be about the business of creating cultures of readers. And so we're going to get excited about that and put some good, great things in place.
Luke, welcome to the program.
Hi,
and we're getting tight on time, so if I can get you to your question fairly quickly.
Yes, not a problem. I'm on a local school board in Danville, and I was wondering what Superintendent Ritz plans on doing to help school boards and local schools achieve some of these goals that she set, like the young reading age and things like that.
Thank you very much for the call, Luke.
Well, actually, all the constituencies will be involved in helping to come up with these great initiatives. I have a very inclusive management style. Mm-hmm. And so really, school boards, superintendents, you know, people that are in the education community, parents will be highly involved, as well as community leaders that are involved in systems to help support the schools. Because it shouldn't be something coming from me or the Department of Education and saying, here, go do this. It should be, what is it that we need to do, and how are we going to get it done? My motto for my theme for this to start out my tenure is actually imagining the possibilities and making them happen. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to have dialogue. We're going to have talk. We're going to decide, you know, how is it that we move forward with what we want to do for the kids in Indiana.
Well, I'm afraid that probably is going to have to be the last word here, but I feel like we could go on for at least another couple hours talking about these subjects. I know from the way the phone banks are lit up here that our listeners could go on for another couple hours, and I would like to apologize to all of the callers and listeners that we were not able to get into the program, but I hope you'd come back another time.
Oh, most definitely.
And talk with us more about these issues as you get a little further into your tenure, perhaps as the legislature gets a little further into its session.
Education is such an important topic for our young people. They're our future, so anytime. I'll come back anytime.
Well, we have been talking with Glenda Ritz. Next week, we will be back at the same time talking about a special event at IUPUI. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for sharing this time with us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.